You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for September 5th, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the very slippery poop deck of the National Review Cruise, featuring John Bolton on Fantasy Island, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Oh my God, is it National Review Cruise time again?
It's time to book your berth on the National Review Cruise with Catherine Jean Lopez, Jonah Goldberg, John Kyle, Fred Reverse Mortgage Thompson, and also Marco Rubio is going to be there, and Ted Cruz, yes.
Really? A cruise?
Ted Cruz on the cruise.
It's the Ted Cruz cruise. Oh, my God.
It's the Ted Cruz cruise. And, yeah, both Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz are going to be on there right after Election Day 2014.
Oh, really?
It is really interesting to watch the National Review cruise because they have to book – people have to book them, you know, now in early September if they're going to go after the election, sometimes earlier.
I understand the 2012 cruise, there was a mass extinction event after Barack Obama was reelected.
What I found interesting, I think, was back in the 2008 cruise.
Uh-huh.
All these people who should have been standing by to be in the McCain cabinet were already planning to be on a cruise.
Yeah. I'm going to be drunk with Catherine Jean Lopez throwing up in my lap.
I can't imagine standing in line for the midnight buffet between Catherine Jean Lopez and Jonah Goldberg.
Yeah.
That would, and I do call it the Dante's Fifth Circle of Hell cruise. It is just John Kyle. You're going to go hear a talk on a boat with John Kyle? Really?
With no way off.
With no way off.
It's just a lot of water and you're stuck on a piece of wood with these people. That Alfred Hitchcock would have a rich adventure with. You know, the Lifeboat 2. I think the living would envy the dead.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com.
It's our first podcast on the new seating arrangement in our...
Oh, and you're sitting on a firmer foundation.
A much firmer foundation. I feel
firmer
more,
foundation.
I don't know, I feel more independent, centristy, I don't know.
Our mattress fell apart. Literally, I mean, we are not going to talk about what happened, but...
No. It was awesome.
All right. It had to be replaced.
Yes,
so.
It had to go. Had to go. What would have been perfect would have been had they decided to store this one temporarily in the basement last week.
We're just going to put it down there for a couple hours, okay?
Sure, what could go wrong there? Yeah.
But we do have good news.
Yeah.
We have good news about the car.
Yes, the Driftglassmobile. It's salvageable.
It's salvageable. That's wonderful news. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful news. That allows us to take the money that we didn't have to spend on a car, spend it on a mattress.
Yeah. Which is awesome. It's gonna smell a little like Florida for a while.
Your car?
Yeah.
Why would the mattress smell like Florida? I was wondering.
No.
Okay.
A little Floridian, a little ocean front, a little swampy. But
they have to do is rip out the carpets and clean them, and that's it.
Well, upholstery and seats and relube everything and
it didn't make it up. The point is, it didn't make it up to the electrical.
That's right. It did hit the electrical. So yay!
So that's very good news.
It's a very hardy little car, and it has it's a
2001.
It's a 2001 paid for. So very nice car. Very great features, including it's paid for.
And we're going to have an estimate or a menu presented to us about our basement next week. Yeah. So we'll let you know what's going on with that. We had some really good advice from one of our listeners. J.E. wrote us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm ready to print out his email because he had...
Emails, plural. He sent it.
Emails, plural. He had some really great ideas on different... valves and sump pump situations and different things to do. The problem is our house and our neighbor's house and then the other neighbor's house on the other side are all very close together.
Yes.
The only thing that separates them is a concrete driveway.
Yeah.
So if we're going to dig a trench around our house, it's going to involve jackhammering driveways.
Yes. Plural.
And that's going to get expensive and difficult. So,
and that if you, as we learned from when we planted our dear old cat,
yes,
dig down about a foot and a half, it's clay.
It's clay, yeah.
So,
it's, which is one of the reasons that when it floods, it really floods. So, but we'll figure out what to do about the basement, and they will provide us with a menu of options, and then we will do a Kickstarter and figure out how to pay for it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But we're alive and well.
Yes. And thank you to those of you who said, oh man, here's 10 bucks. I'm so sorry about the flood. Several of you did that, and it just heartens us so much. Thank you.
Oh yeah. There was that earthquake too. Yeah. No, it was big. And we weren't singled out for special retribution by any divine power. When I
just
went,
what to, you thought Thursday night, you thought that
Irish writer brain kicked in.
Oh my God. Why me? Yeah.
Well, not why me, but why us? Why is this house being punished? Mm-hmm. And but I have to drive a rental around for a little while because I have to get many, many places, and I don't really have a choice. So I have an itty-bitty rental. But if you want to find the best stories about floods and disasters after at the day after, go to the local car rental place.
Car rental place.
Because
they're all there, and right before Labor Day weekend, you had to wait almost 2 hours to get a car.
Yeah, and they were really good. They were working hard. They were doing their job. They were overbooked by 20 cars by noon.
Oh, wow.
The guy who I dropped off my drift class mobile, and who gave me a lift over to the other place, we shared stories about our basement being flooded. So, you know, it was very sort of restorative to know that, oh, this is collective punishment. This is like Sodom and Gomorrah. This is everybody's taking it in the neck. So I don't feel quite as bad. Plus, I have a loving wife.
You do.
And it turned out life just doesn't stop when those things happen.
That's right.
You have to get up the next day and do stuff. So
you have to go to work. You have to do things. Yeah.
And you have to podcast, apparently. So here we are.
We are podcasting. And
thanks again to Scott for just dropping that in our lap.
Yep.
At just the right time.
Just the right time. It was hugely popular.
Yeah. Apparently, we should just stop doing podcasts altogether.
Well,
the acts of kindness and good kind words and generosity. And let me add, I know I'm way behind on writing thank you notes.
Oh, me too.
I know that. It kills me. And I'm a writer, and it kills me because I should be able to just crank these out. And I will.
You and I will.
I promise.
We should sit together and do this.
Yes.
That's what we should do.
Under our vine and fig leaf, and none shall make us afraid. Because it's not raining outside. So, shall we get on with the business of podcasting?
Well, we need to talk a little bit about... We're not going to do a specific science fiction university. But I did want to let people know about a Facebook page called Octavia's Brood.
Yeah.
Which is dovetailing race and social justice issues with science fiction. And it looks just fabulous. I'm really looking forward to digging into that Facebook page and what they're doing. And I watched a little bit of world television this week.
Uh-huh.
You and I were invited and did explore the upper ranges of our cable channels because...
Yes. Yes.
Of the Simpsons marathon up on channel 555.
Yes. Yes.
And up in that range, there is a PBS World Channel, which is heavily African American and lots of documentaries made by African Americans. And I watched about 2 hours of really compelling television. I'll be going back to that. I watch so little TV these days, but there is a documentary. I believe it's called Bridging the Gulf. The organization is called Bridging the Gulf. It's about the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
And the floods and Katrina. And the two documentarians, African-American men, were talking about their film and talking about the Gulf of Mexico as an environment, but also as an environment with a racial identity.
Yeah.
Partnering with the EPA and how foreign that is to communities of color, but finding so much energy from doing that. And one of the things that one of the gentlemen said just blew me away. He said, one of the things we had to do was recognize that there is a we, and we are right.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get this cohesive community together that says, okay, we are part of this environment, And we are right about wanting to protect the grasslands. And mm-hmm. we are right about stopping developers from building where it is going to create flooding.
Yeah.
And they asked him, the host was a woman whose last name is Del Toro. I wonder if she is related to Benicio Del Toro. But she was interviewing them and she said, what can we do to protect the environment of the Gulf? You know, what progress can be made? And the other documentarian said, enforce the laws that are on the yeah. books would be really yeah. great if we just did that, because yeah. It turns out that one developer was told that this land that he wanted to build on was protected grasslands and that he couldn't build on it. And he just decided on his own that it wasn't grasslands. No, it isn't.
No.
And it is that Republican, I'm going to create my own reality and do whatever I want. And no, it isn't. It's not grassland.
Yep.
There's no global
yep.
warming. I don't have to. Tax cuts create revenue. And he started to build on it. I mean, you know, as if
mm-hmm.
it just reality just doesn't matter.
Well, I believe it's part of the area called Streeterville
mm-hmm.
in Chicago was created by, I believe, a gentleman and his wife pulling their houseboat up on what were essentially mud flats and a garbage pile
mm-hmm.
and declaring that this was their property now.
Yep.
Because it just hove into existence. There was this new piece of land that came out of nowhere. And those are delightful, legendary tales to be mm-hmm. told mm-hmm. around the campfire. Mm-hmm. But we can't live that way anymore.
No.
If you screw up, there's no place else to go. I mean, you can't destroy an entire region and then say, well, I guess we fucked that up. Hey, you know what looks good? Alaska looks good. Let's move
yeah.
there.
Yeah. There's also a woman named Majora Carter who I recommend that everyone, in fact, I'll post her video on our Facebook page. She's a environmentalist who is from the South Bronx and who she laughs in her. It's just her talking in this little short film. She laughs about how she graduated from school and was broke and didn't have a job. And so she had to move back with her parents. And all of a sudden she's back with her parents and she's in the South Bronx. And she starts to look at the environment of the South Bronx. And she has a degree now in environmental science. And she sees such an opportunity to bring environmentalism to the South Bronx and how that empowers people. And again, it's the same kind of story mm-hmm. where environments that are seen only as a racial identity start to be seen as environments that have a racial identity,
yes.
but are environments.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you have allies, you have white allies, you have city hall allies. You have a way of talking to people in power where they will listen to you, because it's not just an economic issue. It's a survival issue and it's a health issue. You're bridging all kinds of constituencies there and making allies and bridging, and it really can make a difference. And I'm really excited to see this. And as I say, I'm going to be watching a lot more of World on PBS, because there's just such an opportunity for social change.
Well, you know, that's
racial equality, environmentalism, all issues that I really care about.
That's what the professional left is supposed to be about. Building right? building alliances.
Yeah. And finding connections where you didn't see them before is really... You're... fun.
and
my brain just lights up when that happens.
If we devoted half the time to building alliances that our opponents devote to figuring out the perfect wedge issue
yep.
to pit us against each other,
yep.
This old world would be a much better place.
Yeah. If it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press, Driftglass.
Yeah. Wow.
They're trolling us. I swear to God.
They really are.
Meet the Press is trolling us on purpose.
I told you earlier that it's this plus Luke Russert. This is...
Well, yeah, we should let our listeners know who haven't heard that Chuck Todd, they're going to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
To make Meet the Press a little more dynamic by adding Luke Russert and Joe Scarborough to the mix.
Yeah.
With a little sprinkle of Nia Malika Henderson.
Yeah.
And, Andrea Mitchell will also be back from time to time.
So we're renaming it The Recycle.
The Recycle.
Yeah. Because, Jesus. I mean, And you know what? I got to say, I haven't been in a position to really gauge massive reaction, and I haven't written my little piece on it yet. But
I don't think people have had time to react yet.
Initial reaction has been, holy God, this is, they really had no idea why people hate that show so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take the worst elements of the show, and all the poison that killed it, we're going to double that. And unless they're hoping, as I said before, to you before, I guess if they're hoping for a large audience of ironic viewers, mm-hmm. then that, if that's their new demographic, people who just watch with air quotes, that's great. But if they want to compete with Fox, just be Fox. But there already is a Fox, so you end up...
Well, Driftglass, I want to read a sentence to you from page6.com.
Yes.
Which covered this. Tim Russert's son Luke to be a regular face on Meet the Press. We're told the move is part of a plan to bring a right-leaning voice to the program to appeal to viewers turned off by the show's famously left-leaning former hosts, including the ousted David Gregory.
Yeah, this is what happens when you begin...
to believe that your own farts smell like rose petals.
Yeah, David Gregory has been selling the same disreputable, poisonous product for every minute he's been on the fucking air. And it's both sides. Mm-hmm. Both sides, both sides. So as the right has ratcheted it further and further into crazy town, he's gone right along, booked more Republican guests than Democratic guests, put more wingnuts on there, refused year after year to ask anyone on the right any follow-up questions to any of the crazy shit they spew, to really pathetically try to pander to that demographic. He was trying desperately hard to pander, to suck up to conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, but he couldn't do it by saying liberals are lunatics and they're trash. He had to play the both sides game. Well, this is what you get. You played the both sides game so long that you, David Gregory, have been tea partied. You've been primary.
Yep.
You've been swept from your right. And now Chuck Todd has to come in from your right because there's nobody left on your left. There's nothing left over there. There's only crazy people. There's only people on the right for whom Joe Scarborough looks like a reasonable centrist. And Luke
Russert.
Well,
and that's what I said today about Luke Russert being actually having a useful engine.
Yeah.
That Luke Russert.
Yes, he is.
Because Luke Russert is brought on the show to make Nia Malika Henderson look knowledgeable and Joe Scarborough to look contemplative.
Yeah. He is the wallpaper against which all of them will be cast. And the reason he's there is because he won the birth lottery.
Right.
He is absolutely, he's a dimwit. He has no television presence at all, other than sitting on John Boehner's lap as his surrogate daddy. I don't know what he brings to anything. But he's sort of their Dan Quayle, you know? He's the guy that George Bush said, you know, I need the young voters. So go find me a guy with a haircut who's under 40 or under 50. And they need young viewers, apparently. Some focus group told them that. So they decided, hey, you know what we've got in-house? We've got young people here. Let's put Luke Russert, who is completely incapable of sitting in front of a camera in the middle of the day and not boring the shit out of everyone.
Right, right.
Let's put him in the big chair. Let's put him near the big chair. And just to back him, to brace him, let's haul Joe Scarborough. Holy mother of God. Hauled Joe Scarborough to, I guess, that was the big slap fight. Who was going to take over for David Gregory? Apparently, the answer is everybody is.
Everybody is, yeah.
And it is, I'm certainly not going to watch the show again. I will watch the clips from Crooks and Liars, which are always entertaining. I will mine them for their whatever. But clearly, they're banking on Republican Senate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They've decided that the Senate's going to be Republican. And so then they can have John McCain on all the time. As I said this morning, the only people really watching Meet the Press are the number one hate watchers like us.
Yeah.
People that are just watching it because it's so bad.
Yeah.
And fapping Beltway insiders from the military industrial complex.
Well, and for them, the country ends at the border of the Beltway.
And the border of Meet the Press. Meet the Press is the coverage that they need to hear, and that's it. How are my war stocks doing?
Yeah, this is Rome during the visit from Martin Luther. It is completely rotten and corrupt from top to bottom. And they obviously, there's just, it's so fascinating to watch a train wreck of this proportion that was so avoidable that and to reverse it, because no one's ever going to say, nobody on NBC is ever going to admit what really happened. You know, you have to sign a blood oath when you work there that you're never going to you're never going to hear anyone from MSNBC, the liberal MSNBC, say, holy shit, what have you done? What in the world did you do with the flagship of this network? The number one rated show, Sunday show for, you know, for all the wrong reasons. And you gave it to this centrist douchebag and he tanked it. First of all, Russert was no prize. Mm-hmm. Let's remember that that Tim Russert was Dick Cheney's number one go-to guy for launching Iraq war lies because he knew that he'd fall for it. Tim Russert had that one move. Play some video and go, huh? And that was it. That's what he did. And on election night, he'd take out his little whiteboard and write numbers on it. And that was fine. But it wasn't, he wasn't the second coming of Hunter Thompson.
No, and he was so friendly to the Cheney administration that it was embarrassing.
Yeah, and then he croaked, and they brought in someone so much worse, and in all the wrong directions, so much, just this giant simian empty suit who was a failure from day one. And he, you know, that show, that the fake show they had on 30 Rock, tanking it.
Tanking it.
Yeah. Right. What's our strategy what's our business plan? Deliberately tank the network. And this has that feel. This has the feel of someone really, really wants to fuck this network to death. And hey, here's what we'll do. We'll take all the people you hate anyway and put them in a big taco shell and shove them down your throat every Sunday morning with no redeeming features at all.
And you know, if we can't get this band of idiots.
Yeah.
We'll pull somebody off of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal to come in and talk foreign policy and economics.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be Three's Company, and Mr. Roper's going to be David Brooks.
David Brooks.
You know, exactly. It's going to be so bad. And it's, I'm not saying that because I have any particularly brilliant predictive powers, but these people all have track records. Their track records are all terrible. So, you know, incompetence is not additive. It multiplies in the wrong direction. The more morons and hacks you pile on
the more
clown
they're
car.
Rewarded with a seat at Meet the Press. Yeah, we must be doing the right thing because we're on Sunday morning. Yeah,
and that's the thing about that's, and this is the point at which I depart. I give up on the media. We are the media. You and I, Blue Cow, the blog, etc. We're the media because this is such an atrocious. This reeks so hard. And there's not one single person in the media who's going to report on what really happened. Because everybody wants a job somewhere in that mix. Nobody wants to fuck up their resume or burn the wrong bridge. So you're never going to hear your favorite liberal on MSNBC say, all right, here's the deal. Chuck Todd saw whatever her name is, Debbie Turness, kill a hooker one night. helped her take it to the dumpster. And Luke Russert helped cut up the body. And Scarborough found the pictures. So that's why these people have jobs. Because there's no other fucking reason why people this blitheringly incompetent are being given this job. There is a job for Chuck Todd. The thing is, this is one thing that Charlie Pierce pointed out. Why he calls my man Chuck Todd. If you want to know the election results, if you want to know the likely outcome of some obscure goddamn election in some godforsaken precinct in Kansas, Chuck Todd is your guy.
He knows how to count votes. Yeah.
He lives that shit. He's great at that. So here's what you do. You put him on during the 3 days leading up to an election and 3 days afterwards.
And you know what would be really cool? If you gave him an actual chalkboard.
Yes. And just stood there.
No tech. Just chalkboard.
No, the Russert. Give him the Russert whiteboard. Give him a little thingy that he erased. And then get him the hell out of the living room for when the polite company shows up.
The next 2 years.
When the grown-ups show up. Because he doesn't have – he literally has nothing else to offer other than
– Every two Novembers, it's Chuck Todd's hour.
It's Chuck Todd time. It's Chuck time, baby. And out he'll come. But – and this is how pathetically shallow their bench is.
Yeah.
It's not like these places don't have talented people. They do. We see them every so often in the evenings. We see them. Melissa Harris Perry would be awesome in that mix. The number of times I have seen liberals bite their tongue on the show, mm-hmm. and not just rip David Gregory's head off mm-hmm. for being the douche that he was.
Yeah.
There has to be a blood oath that you're never gonna fight the brand. You're never gonna. Harlan Ellison has this story about working at Disney. You know, did I tell you this story?
Oh, yes, you have. Yes, you have.
Yeah. And it's going great.
Basically, it's going great. And then all of a sudden they have lunch and somebody actually tells the truth about Walt Disney.
No, all the writers are on one table
uh-huh.
and they start having this wonderful, what if Disney made porn?
Oh, yeah.
And they get in there. And it was funny. And apparently Harlan Ellison does a wickedly good Mickey Mouse. And was talking about spreading the labia and getting real close, on. And he was so enamored with being at a table with all of the people he admired, these writers mm-hmm. that he mm-hmm. admired, he didn't notice the fact that their faces were all going horribly white, mm-hmm. and they weren't laughing anymore because sitting right behind them was the executive dining room. And he got back to his brand new office and he was packed up and his name was gone and he had a pink slip and it was over. And he learned an important lesson. You don't fuck with the mouse. When you work at Disney, you don't fuck with the mouse. And you know what? When you work at NBC, you don't fuck with that brand. You don't mention that the people who are on your left and on your right are completely unfit to work there. Even though that is news. And even though you're actually a journalist, and even though that's really big news, you're sworn to secrecy. And that's what makes you inherently uncredible. Because I don't know what else you're not telling me if you're not mentioning that your best show sucks ass for no good reason.
Yep.
Anyway, we got to move on.
I want to add a couple more things about Mr. Press.
Oh, yeah.
The brand works for Northrop Grumman.
Yeah. Oh, and absolutely.
We can never miss that. That is who they are talking to. That is who they are writing for is Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman. That's who they want to make happy as far as their programming at that hour is concerned. And last week, I have a very specific example. Last week, they had on talking about ISIS or ISIN or whatever. I don't know how you want to say it, but the Middle East and the terrorists and how bad everything is. And they had the deputy editorial page editor for the Wall Street Journal, Dan Henninger, on to talk with Andrea Mitchell about, and he was in the roundtable, to talk about American foreign policy and Barack Obama and whether or not we really have a strategy or not. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? And does it matter? Mm-hmm. And Dan Henninger, I went to the transcript. I'm going to read the last paragraph of what he said about does it matter or not, whether Obama's strategy is fully formed yet.
And remember, that quote has been taken
completely out of context.
Like Howard Dean's scream, it has been taken completely out of context.
And like Hillary Clinton saying, what difference does it make?
We lopped off all the contextual material around it.
Mm-hmm.
And, the optics are really bad. Yeah. No, the optics are bad if you forget the sentence that preceded it, but the only person who would do that is a liar or someone who's deliberately trying to bend the truth.
Right.
But he used these words in a row, and it doesn't really matter what the context is.
But you can't do that. You can't do that. And when he did that, I'm telling you, I knew two things. One is they would focus on the suit and the color of the suit because it was different.
Yes.
And you can't do that. That just, that gives you optics to talk about. And if you can't talk about anything, you can talk about somebody's clothes. If you're too stupid to talk about anything, you can talk about somebody's clothes. And the second thing was, I heard what he said, and I said, oh, my God, he just handed a big, huge present to Fox News.
Right.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
I wanted to smack him.
Oh, yeah.
You don't say, we don't have a strategy. You don't say five words in a row that are going to be taken out of context. And you know everything you say is going to be taken out of context. Mm-hmm. But when you're in front of a podium, this was not on the sidewalk somewhere where someone just asked him a question. He was at a podium ready to talk.
Uh-huh.
You don't do that. But getting back to Henninger talking on Meet the Press on behalf of Northrop Grumman and the Wall Street Journal, he said to Andrea Mitchell,
Jesus, it's just
so bad.
Mm-hmm.
This is a political model, a foreign policy model they described earlier in the administration, which was leading from behind. The idea that others would sort of coalesce and take the lead. I think we've seen that does not work. And if you try to lead from behind, you are always playing catch up. And clearly we are playing catch up in both the Middle East right now and in the Ukraine. And the problem when you do that is that your so-called partners begin to make deals on their own.
Bastards.
As Michael Leiter was just describing, the Egyptians and the United Arab Emirates bombed Libya on their own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then he says this, one might say that's a positive development. But in the short term, if people out there start making deals that are only in their interest and not in the U.S. interest, then the United States will have a very hard time getting to the point where we can form a coherent strategy involving our partners.
Uh-huh.
And it reminded me so much of Bill Murray in Scrooged, where he goes up to his secretary and says, if you don't work late, I don't work late. And if I don't work late, I can't work late. If the U.S. isn't in control of everything, we're not in control of everything. And if we're not in control of everything, we're not in control of everything.
Don't you get it, man?
Every sentence he said when I was watching it on TV, I just went, so?
Uh-huh.
So?
You realize every country on earth is our teenage daughter.
And we have to protect and defend.
You know?
And punish.
She, we can't imagine. She's her out there making decisions for herself. That's crazy talk. No, that's paternalism. And when it's your teenage daughter, that's fine. When you're talking about entire nations, that's insane.
It is. And it's patronizing, and it's why so many people become terrorists and call us the great Satan. It's because we've decided that we are entitled to push our agenda at the point of a gun. Yes. And that's our duty.
Yeah.
And John McCain comes on Meet the Fucking Press and says, you know, every 3 weeks at least he's on there. You know, how many countries should we bomb this week, John? You know, to show that we're America. And I'm just sick of it. And if we don't, you know, you talk about the razor and the apple. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
Talk about the razor and the apple with David Brooks and him rewriting the history of the conservative movement.
Uh-huh.
Meet the Press is rewriting the history of how Washington works.
Yes.
Always to favor the military-industrial complex.
Every time.
If we don't peel that off and point out that razor every single time, we're not doing our job.
Oh, and it's because that's who pays the bills.
That's who pays the bills.
And
now we're going to go on to a letter. I'm sorry that we have to cut this short.
No. There's plenty. This is not the last time we.
This is not the last time we'll talk about the Meet the Press. I promise.
No. But we have a really good letter,
and we want to address it as thoroughly as we can in the brief time we have left.
Yeah.
This is from John, and it's about employment. Hi, Professional Left. I've been a listener and supporter for a while now, and I really enjoy your program. Over time, I've heard several references to your expertise in job employment programs. That would be you, Driftglass. And reasons for middle-aged unemployment. My spouse's ex has been laid off from a professional sales position in IT and has now been unemployed for over a year. He is in his mid-50s. This is becoming a desperate situation with the dad now living with his 30-year-old son and new wife. It doesn't appear that there is a way out of this for him, and he is now wiped out financially in later life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please do a segment on the statistics and prospects for people in this situation, as they should be heading towards retirement? Also, I would appreciate your views on why this is happening and any advice on tipping the scales back in his favor. Thanks for all you do, John. And my initial response to this letter, by the way, Driftglass, was, oh my God, this is just happening to him now. It didn't happen to him in 2008 because for most people in their 50s who got laid off, this is an old story.
Like me.
Right.
Yeah. Most people who got laid off, let's say over the age of 45, just to pick a number, it's the depression.
Yeah.
It's not a recession. It's the depression. Because you lost everything and you lost. And in my case, it was sort of a series of dominoes falling that I couldn't control. It was going from a place of relative security. I never lived off credit cards in my life. I hate debt. I did not accumulate debt. I have had one credit card for 20 plus years. The only debt I had was mortgage. I paid off my student loans. I paid off my car. I paid off everything. I pay cash for everything. So I was doing all the stuff you're supposed to do.
And then you can't lose your job and continue to pay your mortgage and maintain your savings and refinance your house and put your house on the market when
the housing market
economy
has
tanked.
The housing market has collapsed. The housing market has tanked and you can't get refinanced because you don't have a job.
Right.
So I have been on unemployment a couple of times. You and I have shared pretty openly the sort of dire financial situations we have found ourselves in. Things are temporarily better.
Things are better right now.
And I am probably, as a spiritual being, much happier than I was 10 years ago. I was promoted, as far as I'm concerned. But it doesn't mean I'm not terrified of my financial future, but I go to bed every night with somebody who I'm delighted to be married to.
Mm-hmm.
And that physically lowers my blood pressure. I mean, that is, I have stepkids I love. And so that I have all that going for me. Now I have two different histories and I won't bore you with both of them, but I have my personal weird history, which is unique to me.
Mm-hmm.
And my history understanding labor markets, economic development, workforce stuff, all that stuff really well.
And I would like to give this person some practical advice.
Yeah.
You know, like 4 or 5 things that you would recommend to someone, because you do have expertise in this area.
Yeah, I do. And the first thing that hit me, the first thing that depressed the hell out of me, I'll be honest with you, is the fact that I know this stuff.
Yeah.
So when it was happening to me, I felt like a doctor, you know, an oncologist who gets cancer.
Yeah.
I know what's going to happen to me. Yeah. I know what the statistics say. I know what probable outcomes are going to be.
And oncologists don't go through treatment, by the way. They don't go through chemo. A very high percentage of cancer doctors, if they get cancer, choose to just die because the treatment, they know how awful the treatment is and how much it doesn't extend life. So that is something to think about. But what would you do for this? Or you're behind the desk helping this person in a professional way. What would you say to him?
First of all, I would tell you I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
I survived.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I, in fact, now am vastly more qualified than I was 15 years ago to do this job, which I no longer do, because now I really do understand down to my bones what you are going through. I really do understand it, and it is terrifying and upsetting, and you've been cheated. This is not the future you were promised. If you played by the rules, this was never supposed to happen to you. And I'm not going to get political or social about the meta reasons for this. I will say that if Elizabeth Warren were president, things would be better than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's neither here nor there. I would say, number one, make sure you don't stop looking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Keep applying for work. Keep working your networks. And work any job you can get. The worst thing, your worst enemy is that gap in your resume.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the thing you have to explain. Get used to the fact that you're going to show up to lots of job interviews with people who are 20 years younger than you.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to dye your hair, do it. If you need to spend a couple of bucks to upgrade your wardrobe, do it. But prepare yourself for the fact that from the moment you show up at the door, from the moment you submit a resume, and for every 50 resumes you send out, you're going to get one response.
Mm-hmm.
So just wrap your head around that. That's just going to happen. From the minute you apply for a job to the minute you get it, the job of the HR department is to not give you that job.
Mm-hmm.
So understand the people in HR who are very professional, often very cheerful, and ordinarily nice people are there to keep you from having a job.
They're gatekeepers, and they aren't there to hire anybody. They're there to make sure that the company doesn't make a mistake in hiring you.
Exactly.
That's their number one job.
The status quo of doing nothing is much safer than hiring you, because you might be a lunatic or might not be great. Or maybe we can get a college kid to do it for a fraction of the cost.
Or an intern for nothing.
And those are the people you're competing with in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Now, you're also there's some stuff going on below the surface. So the HR person is not your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Do not share information with them. As any attorney will tell you, don't answer any questions you are not asked. Don't show off how smart you are. Don't if they want to walk you to your car, it's because they want to check for a baby seat.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to know if you have a family. Because if you have a family, you might quit.
And particularly women get treated that way.
There's a dozen tricks and traps. Understand you're going into hostile country to take something away from them. Mm-hmm. That they don't want to give up. That's the deal. Also understand that there's stuff going on below the surface, just below the surface, that actually works slightly in your favor. I am astonished. This is not true of everybody, but I am astonished at the degree to which college graduates can't form sentences anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can't write a fucking paragraph. The degree of just sort of achingly bad illiteracy that's out there in the world means that if you're a literate person, you're head and shoulders above a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a demographic bulge. There's lots of people who are about your age who are retiring. This is a huge problem in lots of industries. It's a problem in service. It's a problem in medical.
Well, and this person is in sales. I think that should be in a place where you should, and I hate to shoot all over somebody, but don't be afraid to sell something you're not familiar with or that you might not feel comfortable selling. You should be out in sales, taking anything you can get, just to have on your resume that you're still in sales and that's what you like to do. Yeah.
Even if you call yourself a consultant and print to business cards that say you're a whatever. I have a box with about 12 different iterations of my business card based on the careers I've had.
Yeah.
And the jobs I'm doing now or the jobs I'm trying to do now have nothing to do with the career I had 8 years ago,
mm-hmm.
which in turn had nothing to do with the career I had 6 years before that, and on and on and on,
mm-hmm.
because I have had a series of fairly hilarious and tragic, not personally, but career-wise, disasters. And I've had to completely change careers like 3 times, and it's exhausting. So extract what you can from the job you had before, what you're good at. Are you able to read? Are you able to write? Are you able to talk? Have you mastered how to sell the Printmaster 5000?
Mm-hmm.
But are you able to talk to people? And make yourself a consultant, even if it's in name only, so that on your resume it says independent contractor, consultant, whatever. Again, avoid that gap in your resume, that sort of large abyss that says I'm a loser.
Because
you're not. You're just over 45 and you're unemployed. And in a lot of cases, it feels like death.
But you're so not alone. Not alone.
You are. There's an army of us out there. Mm-hmm. There are millions of us out there. And I would avoid sharing too much with members of that cohort. Mm-hmm. It is comforting to be in a group. I definitely work the employment office. Go to your workforce center. Work with the people there. They get paid by your – that's where your tax dollars went, mm-hmm. to hire them. And they're there to find you a job. Now, they might not be able to. It might be exhausting. They might just say, look, you and I both know there's no job out there, so go ahead and use the computer labs, but there's nothing for you.
Mm-hmm.
Get ready for that. But they get – they're in business to get you a job. Mm-hmm. Their funding depends on getting –
they have to get numbers, right? They have to get the numbers in the door and out the door. So they want you to be there. Yeah.
And they want the ones who are easy to employ.
Yeah. Yeah.
And make yourself one of those people. Mm-hmm. Avoid the big gap on the resume so that there's nothing going on there. And do stuff in between. Volunteer, man. Go to a church. Read to children. Mm-hmm. Go help out. There's a wonderful IT program where we live that refurbishes computers for use by poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Find them. There's 10 equivalents in there. Go to the food bank. First of all, if you're not doing anything anyway, let's face it, get out of the house.
Yeah.
It's good for you. It's good to have a place to go in the morning and a place to come back from in the evening. Go out and do something, and you will meet people there. You will meet weird people there, and you'll meet desperate people there, and people who smell funny there. But you will also meet other engaged people who may very well, as you're sharing a sandwich and talking over your life, say, you know what, I've got an editing job that I need done. I've got just a little thing I've been working on, but maybe I could throw a couple of bucks your way. That's a job.
Yep.
That goes on your resume.
Put that on your resume.
That person is now a reference, and that person might know someone else. It really does come down to that kind of networking.
Mm-hmm.
And Lastly, and this is hard to accept, take your old job. If you've been out of work for months and months and months, it might be necessary to take your old job out in the woods and shoot it in the head.
I was going to say, you told me the other day that you need to treat your former career like an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, like a clingy, insane ex-girlfriend. Because it is really, and I'm totally guilty of this myself, fighting the old battles.
Yeah.
Proving to yourself that those fuckers were wrong. Just staying angry about it. And you know what? You have every reason to be angry. I'm not saying that you should get over being angry because life is unfair. You got every reason to be pissed. This is not the life you were promised. This isn't the life you trained for. I myself and people like me, who are liberals, by the way, have been working since I was 17 years old. I worked a lot. I worked crazy hours in crazy jobs. I worked really hard. I did everything you're supposed to do, and the system completely failed me. And so I'm telling you, you have to treat your old job like your crazy ex-girlfriend or your crazy ex-boyfriend. Get them out of your life.
Don't let the drama of that take up room in your head for free. Yeah.
Divorce them. Bury them. I'm not saying you're never going to have a sales job or writing job or tailor job or whatever it is you do. This is sort of more broad advice for anybody out there who's sort of in our situation. Mm-hmm. Find people to share war stories with. Find people who are similarly situated, but don't dwell on it. Yeah. If there's a group of people that you sit down with once a week and cry about, and you want to top each other about how awful your experience was at work, stop seeing those people.
Yeah.
They're not a support group. They're enabling. And it's not like – and I'm not saying anybody out there is just – walking around in sackcloth and ashes all the time because they want to or because they don't have every right to. But if you want to get another job and get back into the working world, you have to accept the fact your life has really changed. You've lost a limb. You've lost – this is one of those two or three things that are way at the top of life tragedies. The loss of a loved one, public speaking, and getting fired are way near the top.
Yep.
So if you're feeling like stress – and depression and exhaustion and your life is over and you're going through PTSD or something similar.
Yeah, yeah.
That's because you are.
Yeah, and get some help.
It's not because you're bad or wrong. It's because you have experienced a tremendous trauma.
A lot of stress, yep.
That you were never expecting. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to go away anytime soon. It's like a divorce or a death. It will be with you for a long time. And so that life's over.
Mm-hmm.
You might find a life very similar to it in another month.
You might find a better life.
You might find a – yeah, I did. But you are not going – but it is healthy to think of it as a thing that the crazy ex-girlfriend, put her in a cab, give her a sandwich, send her away, never see her again. Don't cut off all contact with people who are on your network or that you like talking to, but get used to the fact that you're not an IT salesperson anymore.
Right, right.
That's over. Again, I'm not saying it really is over, but mentally and emotionally – by putting it in the ground and burying it and say, okay, what do I love doing? What am I good at? What am I gifted at? What gives me pleasure? That's a good place to start. And I cannot emphasize enough the virtue of volunteering. Just, if nothing else, it makes you feel great. Doing nice stuff for people just makes you feel better. It just does. Yep. It's how we're wired. So even if you don't come home with another nickel in your pocket than you started in the morning, you will feel better because you did good for other people. And that's my advice.
Thank you, Driftglass.
My pleasure, Blue Gal.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Shiro. Shiro, the word Shiro is Japanese for white. Shiro lives with two other cats and two other dogs. And like all of those animals, is a rescue. He's half Lynx Point Siamese and is full of bouncy energy. He will even play fetch with a plush donut. You throw it and he brings it to you to throw again. He will be happy, it turns out, to make all of his other pet mates jealous by being Internet Kitty of the Week. Good for him. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go, Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Oh, look how the internet kiddies are looking forward to doing this mouse bucket challenge that everyone's talking about.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
If you have science fiction questions for Driftglass, send them along. We'd love to have them. You can send them to mrs.driftglass@gmail.com. That way he won't see them ahead of time.
That's right. Unless, all right, of course, they require some degree of cogitation.
Well, then I forward them on. And like, if they require you to put together a list of stories, then we do that.
And I am perfectly capable, just so you know, of bullshitting for an hour about the most innocuous question you can imagine. So tell us about space, Driftglass. This comes from natural bullshit ability, but also years of teaching class where I've got 90 minutes of material and a 2.5 hour class to teach. And hey, we're going to talk. Let's talk about current events. Let's talk about the interrelatedness of all things. And once you start doing that, it's there. It really is. This is not, you know, I enjoy the subject of science fiction a lot, and I enjoy what it tells us about how people thought about the future in the past, how people thought about human nature in the past. And it's interesting for me to watch the genre change and watch how people imagine their futures to be and how radically different the way we imagine our futures are now than they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. It fascinates me. And it fascinates me how people in the mainstream media keep discovering the same topics that were being written about 50 years ago, 40, 50 years ago. I corrected Harlan Ellison the other day, which is a dangerous thing to do.
Why?
He has a message board.
Yes.
And he had written something about he had just gotten a piece of collectible art, two pieces of collectible art. Somebody had illustrated a beautiful job. I can't think of the artist's name at the moment. A beautiful job of illustrating The City on the Edge of Forever, which is the Star Trek episode. And he wrote something like, you know, now 30 years since my original vision, which, as you all know, I'm sure Gene Roddenberry changed substantially. This guy, because he'd already printed the screenplay as a book, because all writers recycle everything that they've ever written over and over again. But an artist had illustrated it for him and really brought his vision visually to life. And he's delighted with it. And he had dinner with the guy. The guy gave him or sold him a couple of the original pieces. And that was delightful. But I said, at the risk of being a public stickling, at the risk of being ticketed for stickling in public again, I believe you meant 50 years ago.
I was going to say, it wasn't 30 years ago.
And it was 1967 or 68. But that's a long time ago. Mainstream science fiction on television has been going on for a really long time. And mainstream science fiction in the form of pulp, not mainstream science fiction, but the core, the thing that made it possible, has been going on for 70 years, 75 years. It's a literature with a long history. And it's a largely American, not exclusively American, because, you know, there was Jules Verne and so forth, but Stanislaw Lem and lots of good Russian science fiction. But it's something that's ours almost. And it's been going on a long time. And what it tells us.
Don't forget the Brits. The Brits are pretty good at it.
The Brits are amazing. Yeah. No, yeah. And British television was thick with the stuff, and British movies, Village of the Damned or the and so forth. But the upshot being, it's a long, rich literature.
Yeah.
It's no longer the junkyard. It's no longer something you have to hide behind another cover. And what it tells us about how we think about ourselves, what we think about human nature, that's the core of every great literature. So I'm happy to talk about any aspect of it you like.
What's your favorite David Bowie song?
Man. The first David Bowie song I remember hearing was Diamond Dogs.
Oh.
heard it at a Halloween party. And I said, who the hell is this?
Yeah.
He's young.
Because he can really sing.
He's a really good singer.
Yes,
he is. I would have to say Heroes, the full extended version of Heroes. 5 Years is a really beautiful song. 5 Years, that's all we've got. I saw him in concert, as you did a couple of times.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. And I saw him in Chicago at the Blackstone Theater playing the Elephant Man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I found out later that he, during that performance, a friend of the family had gone to see a different performance and just walked backstage and talked to him and gotten an autograph. I said, you're kidding me. That's when it came to me that sometimes celebrities don't live on glass mountaintops.
Yeah.
You can walk right up to them and say hello, and they're a lot like you and me. Now, David Bowie married Iman and had this amazing life and is still doing amazing things. And
is
so
incredibly
forth.
Happily married.
Yeah. Yeah. And
like somebody else I know.
Yes. and has been doing this for a long time.
Oh, yeah. And he just, the thing I love about David Bowie is he never lets himself get stale. He just does not. Oh, no, this would be interesting to do. And you know,
and even
artists
work.
Like that. And, he's a painter, but David Hockney's like that. You know, I'm going to paint big opera stages now.
Yeah.
I painted pools for a while. Now I'm going to, I etched for a little while. Now I'm going to paint big opera things. And this is interesting to me. And you just. And
it's to him. It's what interests me.
Yeah. Yeah.
David Bowie did an album after 9/11 that has a couple of really good songs on it
mm-hmm.
That I still remember. He did him and Trent Reznor doing I'm Afraid of Americans.
Oh, yeah.
It's a wonderful song.
Really great song.
And once you start realizing, Jesus, he's been singing. And, you know, of course, that he's a member of the Coffee Generation, as you know. but and crooning with Bing Crosby, doing White Christmas with Bing Crosby. It goes back a long, long, long way. So I would have – and I like – Boys Keep Swinging, because it's such an absolutely unapologetically pop anthem.
I like Life on Mars and Young Americans.
Yeah.
And I love the Low album. I just love the Low. Sound and Vision is such a great song. And the whole thing is such a great album. It just is. That's it. Suffragette City, another one I just love.
And it's one that I go to for I don't know if you do this as an artist or writer. Some lyrics are good at sparking my imagination.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, listening to Bowie when you're getting ready to write something is a great idea.
If you're mad, it's no game. Turned all the way up to you know, he's fascist. You know, the way he just says certain words, the way he makes the sound pop is good for the imagination. And you can listen to anything like that. But I think David Bowie is a masterful musician and wonderful singer, and I don't know what prompted the question, but
I heard on the radio. I heard somebody saying, "What's your favorite David Bowie song?" on the radio, because our 10-year-old cannot leave the if she's sitting in the front seat cannot leave the radio dial alone. So she's constantly changing it. And some disc jockey somewhere said, "What's your favorite David Bowie song?" And I thought that is the hardest question I can imagine answering.
And we're here. We are in Science Fiction University, and he is the man who filled the Earth. So
he is.
I think we just keep this as is. I'm
good conversation.
Yeah.
All right. Catch love you.
Love you too, baby.